The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect introduces View columnist Will Noyles. He's going to talk to us about the budget and the play-by-play that's gone on since the budget was introduced and before the vote on the budget in the provincial legislature. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. What was the big news with the budget? I understand they froze welfare. I understand they're planning to take away the community startup.
Yeah, as well as the home repair thing that would help those on ODSP that happen to own a home, if their furnace went or something like that.
Right.
It would help with those costs.
Yeah. So I gather they're just supposed to save this out of their magnanimous benefits, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The worry that I have is that after speaking to a few caseworkers for both OW and ODSP, they admitted that they use that community startup benefit to help people who may be close to being evicted from their unit.
Okay.
So they can help with getting their arrears caught up so that they're not thrown out, as well as it can help with their arrears for hydro so they avoid having their hydro shut off.
Very good. I thought we had a fund for that. Is that gone too now?
There is a fund for home heating that some community agencies have.
Right.
The budget's mute on what they're doing with that. I'm assuming it's being kept at the same price or at the same limit.
What was the limit?
I'm trying to remember because it all depends on each individual community how much they got.
All right. Yeah, I found it objectionable after 20 years of declining incomes that if their estimate of your budgeting reveals that you're spending more than you're taking in, which is highly likely if your income's been declining for 20 years, they'll just hand you a piece of paper and tell you to go talk to someone else and get some help and then come back and try again. They don't have any method for accommodating these people or helping them adjust to their falling income. They just kick them out on the sidewalk.
Yep.
It's an aside, you know, it's not the budget, but it seems like another agency baffle gab.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because there's only so much per community, if there's enough demand in that community, you could find yourself SOL if halfway through the year if they run out.
Yeah. Yeah, if they don't manage their money wisely, I guess, or they don't get enough to start. What else was in the budget?
They're keeping health below 2%. Increase, which is a substantial decrease considering that there's normally a 6% hike to health care spending. So it's basically a 4% decrease if you look at.
Yeah.
There's also cuts to the Ministry of the Environment.
No.
The government claims that they'll be able to keep enforcement going even with this cut.
Right.
I'm not sure I agree, but I guess only time will tell. Hopefully we don't end up with another Walkerton on our hands.
What a thought. What a thought. Change governments and nothing else changes.
But sadly, the government's basically trying to balance this budget on the backs of the poor.
Yeah, I have those figures for the health shrinkage. It's 2.1% is the cap, and 6.1% is the average growth over the past decade.
Yeah, they've played most poverty activists for fools because they introduced that poverty reduction strategy in 2008, and it was supposed to reduce child poverty by 25% in 5 years. They've reduced it a few percentage points over the last 2 years, but now it's only going to increase because the cost of living is going up by about 3%, and there's going to be no increase if the budget goes through as presented. So that's a cut.
Yeah.
At this point, the only party that can really fight an election is the Liberals.
Why? They're the only ones with the funding in the organization?
Right. Because right now, the Conservatives have a debt of about $6 million.
Okay.
So their chances of getting another bank loan are probably zilch.
Okay.
And the NDP have a debt of about $4 million. And, of course, they would be hard-pressed to come up with money for another election as well.
Really? Okay. So you would be counting on popular support for them then?
I think there would be popular support, but whether they could raise the money needed to fight an election is the other question.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other thing is, if we go into an election, what's the turnout going to be?
That's a good question. That's a good question because all the people who are hurt by the tax on home heating fuel, the freeze in fixed incomes after 2 years of cuts at 1% increase, and the child care that's apparently lacking, I hope these people stand up for what they want.
You would hope so, but unfortunately, one of the reasons why I think governments have always basically tried to hit the poor is because they know that they have the poorest turnout along with youth.
We need a multimedia campaign to get youth to turn out for the election, I guess.
Yeah.
Or maybe even before an election to persuade McGuinty that they'll turn out for the election.
I know during this past election, Poverty Free Ontario launched a campaign to try and get people that were serious about poverty issues to go out and vote.
Really?
Yeah.
They missed me.
Okay, I was given a big lawn sign that I had out in my yard.
Poverty Free Ontario. Where are they based, Toronto?
I know that definitely there's probably representation from the Hamilton Poverty Reduction Roundtable.
Okay.
I know there were some groups down here in Niagara that were involved.
And this isn't 25 and 5. This is another organization.
Yeah, but they're all kind of interrelated.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll ask. I'll make that connection and go. So what do you think we're facing? We don't know when we're going to vote on the budget. We don't know what Horvath's demanding, although she's indicated a lot of preferences. We don't know where McGuinty's drawing a line except to say he won't spend any more money.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about this upcoming budget vote?
Not at the moment. There's nothing clear. I know that one thing that Dwight Duncan has poo-pooed is Horvath's idea of capping CEO salaries for hospital CEOs.
Yeah, and I'm surprised. I'm surprised that he would do that. He's not the Minister of Health. What's the game there?
Yeah, well, and the other thing, of course, is that this is the same government that last year was talking about capping hospital CEO salaries, and yet they did nothing about it.
So they've been heavily lobbied from the sound of it.
I'm guessing so, yeah. And I tend to agree with Andrew Horvath on this because if we're spending less on health care,
yeah,
why should we be giving some hospital CEO $700,000 a year?
And more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like down here in Niagara, the province took over the local health system.
Right.
And appointed Kevin Smith from Hamilton to be the supervisor.
Right.
The CEO that they had before, who was fired last January without cause.
Yeah.
She received $650,000 last year and didn't even work.
Just to go away.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we don't know if there's more to come in next year's, because they still haven't said how much was actually paid to her to make her go away.
I see.
Dwight Duncan's trying to say that the cap would be difficult to enforce.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That the hospital association warned that a limit would be a terrible mistake that would chase executive talent out of Ontario.
Right. I beg to differ. Maybe you agree. When Ontario capped generic drugs, a lot of other provinces sat up and took notice. If Ontario caps hospital fees, a lot of other provinces are going to sit up and take notice too.
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's why I think it's a lot of scare tactics.
Yeah, it sounds like the Liberals are trying to paint the NDP as a tax and spend party and make some hay off that rather than dealing with the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And playing politics at this juncture tells me that they're pretty confident they're not going to face an election. I don't like that. I don't like that arrogance. If anybody else figures it out, and I'm sure we're not the only two, nobody else will like that either.
I'm just wondering if the Liberals think that they can just walk all over the NDP and that they'll cave in, or whether the government will actually agree to the majority of the demands in order to get the budget through.
Yeah.
Because I know that there were Liberal MPPs who were also taken aback by the cuts to ODSP and all the benefits. Yeah.
Really? I didn't know. Do you know who they were?
I'm guessing that one of them is the new MPP for Windsor West.
I'm guessing, too. What's their unemployment rate, about 16%?
Yeah, and of course, her job prior to being elected was the Director of Social Assistance and Employment Opportunities for the region of Windsor.
Okay.
So she knows exactly the ramifications of doing this.
Yeah. And now it's time for a break. Hamilton's own Harrison Kennedy. Could be me. Could be you.
Rock for a pillow. Cold ground for a bed. Night sky for a blanket. Cardboard for a bed. They are the homeless. Now here's a new. One day, it might be me, could be you. Downtrodden, Lord, how it must be. People staring at you like you're not real. They are the homeless. Now here's some news. Well, one day, could be me, could be you. Hard rock for a pillow. Cold ground for a bed. Night sky, the only blanket. Lord, they're sleeping on a cardboard bed. It's up to me. It's up to you. Tell a politician what to do. Fight for the homeless. Don't be ashamed. 'Cause one day soon could be you. On me again. Thank you.
I'm surprised the health minister didn't speak up, too, because Gary Block from St. Michael's and Health Providers Against Poverty went into the Star and said he's worried that it's a cut with a dull knife, that the cuts will affect most of all his patients' health at the extreme end of poverty.
Yep.
And so they're going to drive up healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
And this has dumbfounded me for the last 8 years. Rather than paying for a welfare system that works, they're actually paying out of their pockets for the damage that it does, on and on and on.
Yeah, but for some reason, though, the government still hasn't caught on to the fact that there are health ramifications to having people live below poverty.
Or else they've decided they won't be in power by the time that happens and they can shift the blame.
Yeah, there's always that possibility as well.
That's pretty cynical.
First, they had the discussion, the second discussion paper issued by Francis Lincoln and Muneer Sheikh from the Social Assistance Review Commission that overlooked all the concerns that were raised during the consultations last summer.
Yeah.
There was already concern there that the government had manhandled that part of the commission.
All right.
I tend to think that it's maybe more that Muneer Sheikh wrote this discussion paper as opposed to Francis Lincoln.
Oh, yeah? So the emphasis on statistics rather than input.
Well, and of course, the whole idea that if we increase employment, that somehow this will lift people out of poverty.
Oh, yeah, the rising tide and all that.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I just don't buy the whole myth that if they suddenly get a job, they're going to be out of poverty, because most of the jobs that they're going to get are probably minimum wage.
Yeah.
And minimum wage is still below the poverty line.
Absolutely. And still damaging to your health.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other problem with the discussion paper was that it was trying to pit the working poor against those on social assistance.
In what way?
Basically by saying that if we increase social assistance, then we're going to be putting them above the working poor, and that somehow that'll be a disincentive for people to get off of social assistance.
Right.
That feeds on that whole myth that somehow people are living on social assistance because it's easy and they don't want to work.
Yeah, that's true.
And I've never bought that argument because most people I've met who are on social assistance would rather be working.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody really wants to be sitting at home all day doing nothing.
No.
That's why a lot of people that are on social assistance are out there volunteering, because it's something to keep their minds active.
Well, and it gives you a place in the community.
Right, because everybody wants to feel a part of the community, and unfortunately, if you're living that far below the poverty line that just getting out is a drain financially, you're going to start to feel isolated and alone.
Yeah. Got an article here by Simon Black earlier in the month of March that says if welfare was to be returned to pre-Harris levels, the government would have to raise rates by close to 60%. You can be sure that such an increase is not in the cards in the current political climate. But that's how far Harris and McGuinty, to name two names in the same breath, have taken us down. Close to 60%.
Yep.
It is hard to input into the community at that rate, especially when you don't even have a bus pass. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
And if they cut these community startup benefits, I can see more people being evicted and more people having their hydro shut off.
Well, every community, I think, except Toronto, cut the $100 volunteer stipend too, didn't it? And Toronto didn't cut it only because they were caught in the act.
Okay.
Yeah. So even volunteering doesn't get you any extra money, anymore, except apparently in Toronto.
And the other concern is that for those on Ontario Works, by cutting that emergency benefits, that means there's more people who are going to be going without dental care.
Oh, dear, yeah.
And now, mind you, the dental care provided right now basically consists of just pulling a rotten tooth.
Yeah.
But even that's better than having to live with the pain that somebody would have from a toothache.
Yeah. Well, so and the risks. I mean, it's linked to heart disease. It's linked to early mortality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're going to end up with more people in the emergency room.
Yeah. And cardiac procedures and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And basically, by doing this, I know I probably stated in my column, but by introducing the budget the government did, they basically threw Meneer Shake and Francis Lincoln under the bus.
Yeah.
Because what's the point of releasing a poverty reduction strategy now if you've basically already said that you're eliminating all these benefits and you're not going to increase the rates?
Lower child care subsidies, to quote Simon Black again, larger waiting lists for social housing, persistent unemployment, more people caught in the dilemma of whether to feed the kids or pay the rent, changes to employment standards and labor law, which create conditions to lift people out of poverty, will be derided as unfriendly to business. How then do the poor make gains in a climate of austerity? Before we mine history for answers, we must first ask, who are the poor? It's not a question that even the review of social welfare seems to have answered with any great impact, because it hasn't come through publicly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was their opportunity. Who are the poor? And they haven't drawn a line around them. I would think it would get through to all but the most affluent that Ontario's government is not doing any favors to the middle class on down. And that means no favors for business either, because their workforce is untrained and unemployed for ever-increasing length of time. Where are they going to get the people for the recovery and the expansion to follow? These people have been on the streets for 3-4 years now, maybe more. How do you welcome them back to work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't like it. Ontario.
Yeah, because in order to get a job, you need a place to be living in the first place.
Yeah, that's true.
Because how else are you going to be able to provide a phone number or a contact information when you apply for a job?
I've seen people do it sleeping at the Sally Ann and providing a voicemail box, but that's a pretty poor way to stay in touch.
Yeah.
And pretty poor way to go to work in the morning, too, when you're supposed to have had a good night's rest.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Where are the checks and balances that throw a government like this out on its ear? And we can't even be sure that that's what Horvath wants to do.
I think with the NDP, she's going to have, or MPPs like Sherry DeNovo and Michael Prue,
right,
who are not going to back down on increasing ODSP.
Really, eh?
Yeah, because they're very heavily involved in the anti-poverty movement, both of them.
Well, good.
Because that's Sherry DeNovo's background to begin with. She was a United Church minister, and of course her church was heavily involved in anti-poverty initiatives in Toronto.
Right. Okay.
And Michael Prue had been their social assistance critic before.
Okay.
And has met with a number of these groups, so he's well aware of the challenges, and I've talked to him on a number of occasions, and he's honestly a passionate man.
Yeah, we've had him on the show, and he's been a passionate man on the show, too.
So I think she's going to have MPPs who are going to tell her that you can't back down on this one. The one thing I heard is that apparently those on Ontario Works tend to move about 5 times in 1 year.
Oh, no.
Now, they can only get the startup every 2 years, but still, that's probably helping them with their moving costs or with first and last month's rent.
Yeah.
And it's because they're always trying to find somewhere cheaper to live.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, rents are not on their side with the allowances.
No, and of course, the government hasn't committed any new dollars to affordable housing.
No. No, the $100 nutrition fund that was touted never materialized, and the housing allowance geared to the community you live in has never materialized either. In fact, you know, looking inside McGuinty's brain, I don't want to be snide here, but I don't see much that actually has materialized.
No, it's just been a lot of talk, really.
Yeah.
The Liberals have been good ever since 2003 about talking a good game when it comes to poverty, but doing nothing when it comes time to do anything.
I wonder about the cost to the Liberals of this. This is an aside. This isn't really about the budget, but I remember Mulroney and his baffle gab made the Conservatives vulnerable to takeover by a much smaller party, the Reform.
And, yep.
I wonder what the public perception of the Liberal as liars is going to do to the Liberal Party. I mean, the feds have just gone through this, right? The federal Liberals, and now the provincial Liberals are just following the same path.
Yep.
I don't think the public responds to that very well, and I think their response to that is long-term, too. I'm hoping in this case that it is, because we don't need even a party that looks like liars to us, whether they're liars or not. A party that talks up a lot of options and then doesn't deliver any of the ones they talked about, for sure. Okay. Any wrap-up comments for you on this budget and the ongoing play-by-play as we approach a vote?
Well, what I would do is I would encourage everyone to log on to the NDP's budget website and have their say.
It's a Facebook website, right, though?
No, it's an actual website.
Oh, okay.
And they've also got a 1-800 number as well.
I was trying to get on the NDP website, and all I could find was a Facebook connection. You basically permit Mark Zuckerberg to post anything about your life that he can find. Do you have a website address for the NDP website?
I did. Let me just see if I can find it real quick. Okay, it's www.ondpcaucus.com slash Your Say.
www.ondpcaucus.com/yoursay. Your Say.
And the 1-800 number is 1-855-ONT-BDGT.
Oh, really? 1-855-ONT-BDGT.
Yeah, so short for budget.
Yeah.
Because the more support that the NDP caucus have for ensuring that there's no more hits to the poorest among us is probably the best thing.
Okay. Well, we've urged the listeners to do so. Good. Well, I thank you for your time and your support and your insight, and especially for those last two addresses.
No problem.
Let's hope we get a date for that vote and things start heating up in these so-called negotiations.
Yeah, I'm guessing myself is that with the break right now that there's probably negotiations going on in the back rooms.
Okay. And when do they come back? I think it's the 23rd, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Would there be an immediate vote?
I'm guessing there would probably be a few days of debate.
Okay. All right.
And it's probably going to have to go, because they'll probably, I don't believe there's even been a second reading vote yet. So there's still debate whether they send it for, they'll probably have a couple of days of consultation that people can speak to the budget committee in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'd be more debate before the third vote.
Sounds like early May.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned and we'll watch your column and view.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
No problem.
Have a good night.
You have a good night as well.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
At the midpoint of the show, we have a new album for you. Mike Stevens and Matt Anderson in Push Record, the Banff Sessions. And this is Snowplow.
2, 3, 4... Wow. hang on the side. If you see me near your driveway, you better run and hide. I'm a snowplow, I can see in front of my face. I'm a snowplow, gonna knock you out of your place. And it doesn't stand a chance. You better grab your gloves and your shovel, put on your coat and hat. I'm a snowplow, I can't see in front of my face. I'm a snowplow, gonna knock you out of your place.
Disrespect welcomes Simon Black, a researcher at the City Institute of York University and sometime op-ed columnist for The Star. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff.
Okay. We're here to talk about the fallout from the budget and the ongoing discussions around the budget and negotiations where nobody's drawing any lines in the sand, but lots of people have things they won't do.
Right. We're in a weird kind of situation right now.
Yeah.
We have a minority government, the NDP ostensibly holding the balance of power.
Right.
And putting forth recommendations to change the budget, which the government doesn't seem to be that receptive to.
Yeah.
So we're not really sure right now whether we're moving towards a new election, or whether the Liberals are just playing hardball and really in the back rooms are negotiating some changes with the NDP.
One of the things that occurred to me, and I don't know if it's even likely, but just watching the news unfold, is that the NDP's coming up with alternative after alternative. And it strikes me that that would be an excellent strategy for arriving at an agreement if you were trying to drive your opponent, the Liberals, into just saying, stop, stop, we'll do this, just shut up, let's get on with it.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. Because I mean, Andrea said she isn't going to draw a line in the sand.
I think that's what it is. I think the NDP is unsure about what an election would bring.
Especially with no money. Yeah.
Right. I think they're not in a great position financially. I don't think any of the parties are relishing spending the amount of money that it takes to fight an election. Right. But at the same time, NDP must be worried about what would happen if an election was held. I think there's been a lot of polling suggests that people are really receptive to some of the NDP's ideas, particularly the 2% proposed 2% tax increase on people with incomes of 500,000 a year over.
Yeah.
Polling has been really positive on that proposal, as have some of the other proposals been well received by the public, according to polls, like the job creation tax credit, the preservation of child care.
What's a job creation tax credit? Is it a corporate tax credit?
Yeah, it's essentially a tax credit for job creators. So it rewards businesses that create jobs with a tax credit, as opposed to an across the board business tax reduction or corporate tax reduction.
Oh, very good. Okay. That was an NDP idea.
One of Obama's proposals in his last budget negotiations in the States.
Okay.
But this budget, if I could just get to some of the details of the Liberal budget,
please,
at least from the perspective of low income people in Ontario. I mean, the budget was announced, I guess, 2 Mondays ago now, and the Sunday prior, I think we saw probably one of the most perverse publicity stunts in the history of Canadian politics. The McGuinty and the Liberal team showed up at the Cabbage Town Youth Center. Cabbage Town Youth Center is a center located in the east end of Toronto, and has historically served kids from Regent Park and other low-income communities.
All right.
And so this is Sunday before the budget was announced. And he stood at the podium there, set up in the gymnasium, and he said, and I quote, "We are not prepared to balance this budget on the backs of families who may find themselves in difficult circumstances."
Right.
"Or on the backs of our children."
Right.
Now, this is one day before the budget is released, which freezes welfare rates, including ODSP.
Yeah.
You know, as the cost of necessities are going up.
Yeah.
And that also reneges on a promise to add an additional $100 to the Ontario Child Benefit.
Yeah.
So poor children are going to be denied a $100 payment that they were to receive next year.
Right.
Now, this saves the government $90 million.
I see.
And so when he's talking about making tough budget choices,
yeah,
we have to ask, you know, who is it tough for?
Yeah.
Definitely not tough for Ontario's corporations who remain awash with cash that they won't invest to create jobs.
Yeah.
It's not tough for high-income earners, who have bounced back very well since the recession, and their portfolios are doing fine, thank you very much. But to actually go, I used to think the man was just a compulsive liar.
Yeah.
But to actually go to the Cabbage Town Youth Center to make that announcement prior to the budget, to me, was just perverse.
Yeah.
This really topped it for me. Yeah. And it has to, I mean, it's essentially this budget abandons the province's commitment to reduce child poverty by 25% by 2013, which is what was announced in 2008 with the poverty reduction strategy.
Yeah, and I mean, even that was a bit of a letdown in that we were expecting them to tackle poverty as a whole, not just child poverty.
Right.
And not just child poverty as a measure of crossing over a line of percentages, but, you know, a real lift to children in poverty rather than just playing with numbers. And
right.
Yes, they've moved some people over the line, but they're going to go back now, aren't they?
I think so. I think the success of the Ontario Child Benefit in particular was, from reports I've read, is that it lifted 20,000 children out of poverty since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
We still have 1 in 7 kids in this province living in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
To reach that 25%, they were going to have to lift another 71,000 more out of poverty by 2013.
Yeah.
But to get back to the rate freeze, I mean, this is last year there was a 1% increase in welfare, which mm-hmm. is about $7 a month for mm-hmm. an individual receiving help. It leaves a single mother raising two preschool kids about 56% below the poverty line. Now,
you mean almost half the poverty line?
Right. That's mired deep in poverty, that All far right. below the poverty line.
All right.
Now, to say that we now have to balance the budget on the backs of these families, to me, is just unacceptable. And I think part of the responsibility for where the government has moved and it's reneging on its commitment has been the kind of official anti-poverty movement's line with this. I think we've let them, I'm talking because I've been part of this movement, we've let them off the hook way too easy. When they made that initial province, promise
yeah.
of reducing 25% child poverty by 2013,
yeah.
We needed to hear the voices of the 75% that were going to be left out.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was too quickly, I thought, that groups like Campaign 2000, you know, the mainstream groups, the faith groups, were too willing to kind of go along with a very timid anti-poverty strategy that was laid out.
Yeah.
Timid goals that were going to leave way too many people, children and adults, suffering in poverty in this province.
Yeah.
And now we have, I think we partly see that the seeds that were sown back in 2008 in terms of how the anti-poverty movement was going to relate to this government
yeah.
and was going to give it too much of a pass.
Okay.
I don't think they felt the political pressure to do anything when it came to this budget.
Yeah.
I don't think they thought there was going to be consequences
yeah.
as a result of these measures that they've taken. Now, some anti-poverty groups in the province, like OCAP and ACORN, have kind of rejected this the anti-poverty or the poverty reduction, that formal poverty reduction platform, since it was introduced, and kind of saw it for the charade that it was and that it is.
Yeah.
And I think it's up to the more mainstream anti-poverty groups to start taking a harder line with this government. That's the only way we're going to get movement.
Yeah, and I wonder if they are shocked by the backtracking that's gone on in the name of reducing the deficit when it's the poor who pay the balance. I don't know if the means. I'm sure the religious group must be quite shocked.
I think so. I think you've seen expressions of outrage in you go on the websites of various groups in op-eds. I've looked at op-eds that were in the Ottawa Citizen, the Toronto Star, and the Spectator. Where people have expressed real disappointment with this budget when it comes to the needs of low-income Ontarians. But
yeah.
that in and of itself does not push them in the opposite direction. I mean, I think that one of the NDP's proposals in terms of reforming this budget, changing it, has been that 2% tax increase on income earners or over 500,000.
Right.
And one of the results of that was going to be that ODSP was going to increase 1%.
Oh no.
Now even the NDP is dividing, you know, the deserving from the non-deserving poor. There's
yeah.
no mention of OW recipients.
No.
The focus is again on ODSP because, you know, within at least this is how the political parties see it, the ODSP are considered the deserving poor, and the public doesn't seem to have at least what they think the public believes doesn't have a problem with providing increased assistance to people who are disabled,
even if it's less than the increase in the cost of living repeatedly
right.
over 20 years,
which it is. I think food prices last year rose about 4.1%.
Yeah.
Energy costs were about 7.2% in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
So even a 1% ODSP increase proposed by the NDP measures is actually a cut.
Mike Stevens and Matt Anderson, Canadian Winter Blues.
Kitchen and my pipes are frozen too. There's no heat in my kitchen and my pipes are frozen too. Sitting north of the border with these Canadian winter blues. Wind chills minus 30, must be minus 40 in here. Wind chills minus 30, must be minus 40 in here. I've got icicles in my coffee, there's a narwhal sitting in my chair. I got my truck stuck in Turkey Uptown. I left my left boot, but find a muckler. I lost my tube down, pulled it in Maine, and I'll stay inside until it's summer again. Driveway, there's a mountain in my yard. Snowplow filled my driveway and left a mountain in my yard. Snow just keeps falling and I can't even see my car. I got my truck stuck in Tuckdeucta. I lost my left boot, but I found a muckler. I lost my tube down in Portage in Maine, and I'll stay inside until it's summer again. I've been dreaming about the summer as I try to start my skidoo. Just dreaming about the summer as I try to start my skidoo.
So you think it's up to the individually organized anti-poverty groups to say the emperor has no clothes here?
I think so. I think we need an anti-poverty movement that causes a bit of ruckus in this province. And right now we don't have that. And the only way we can get it is through the tough everyday work of organizing.
Yeah.
In low-income communities.
I'm mindful of a T-shirt that I saw a couple of years ago. As far as I know, it's still being produced by a firm in Mississauga called Orange Dingo. And I wanted one. I still want one. I want especially to walk into the ODSP office with one. It says, "You don't pay me enough to be nice to you." Yeah. Right.
That's really funny you mentioned that, Jeff, because one of the things that we've heard from SARC, from the Social Assistance Review Commission, is not only that, you know, everybody knows the rates are too low for people to survive. You can't pay the rent and feed the kids, as the slogan has gone on rates the way they are. But over and over again, you hear people, you hear recipients saying, you know, I want to be treated with dignity in the welfare office.
Yeah.
And that whether that's in the United States or whether that's in Britain, this is a demand that you will hear from from people who are forced to go into a welfare office and ask for what is their social right, and that is assistance to allow themselves to
survive
and live with dignity.
HCAP is formed here, and one of their members told me on a street corner demonstration recently that he was just upset with the welfare office's policy, loudly proclaimed by signs and posters of zero tolerance.
Right.
You know, he said, well, zero tolerance for what? Zero tolerance for starving welfare people? Zero tolerance for people that want jobs and can't get training. What is this zero tolerance? Why don't we have zero tolerance for assaults on people's dignity?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I spoke to a rally a couple of weeks ago with QP 966, which is the union that represents they represent social service providers in Peel Region, and some of those providers are OW caseworkers.
Right.
And, you know, poor people in general don't have great relations with their caseworkers.
Yeah.
And I said to this rally, I said, there's a real need. Like, they're being pushed to go on strike by the region of Peel.
Yeah.
And essentially by the province, which is, you know, making all these cuts. And I said, there's a real need to rethink how we build solidarity between those who use services and those who provide services.
Yeah.
This is a government that we should be, in solidarity, marching against and making demands on. And but that's a very difficult chasm to overcome because of the power that caseworkers have in welfare offices and the experience of the welfare system that many poor people have.
I guess we have a building process underway. Where do the organizers come from? The union movement?
This is the age-old question on how we organize and how we organize poor people's movements.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. We need groups. I think ACORN has proved itself to be a good model. I think OCAP has a particular approach that is a worth replicating in other communities. I think there's some great people in the union movement who do work around poverty, as there are in groups like Campaign 2000 and in the faith groups.
Yeah, maybe it's a sorting out that we're seeing. Maybe it's a sorting out of the people who see the need to go forward more aggressively, and the people who thought that their activism was simply going to be sitting around a table talking and getting approval from government officials.
Right.
Yeah,
and maybe there's
a schism occurring that is good for everybody.
I think that could be the case, like you say. You know, it is a sorting out. Maybe, you know, the conversation that we're having today is a conversation that people are going to have. You know, the thousands of people who have been involved in SARC and in the poverty reduction roundtables that have taken place in communities across the province. You know, that's the type of conversations that they'll be having.
Well, I do hear about it from activists that some of them are just walking out of organizations that are not accomplishing anything and appear not motivated to accomplish anything other than talk or produce reports.
Right.
However useful they are as a basis for action, without the action, they don't accomplish much.
Yeah, okay. I'm a real believer, Jeff, and I've said this on the program in the past, that the power of poor people really comes from their ability to disrupt the business as usual.
Yeah.
Unlike workers who can, you know, walk off the job. Well, nowadays a lot of them are legislated back to work before they've.
Right.
So the power of the strike has been diminished. Traditionally, poor people's power is lay in their ability to disrupt the welfare office.
Yeah.
To be able to sit down, to be able to stop evictions from happening by joining en masse to kick the sheriff out of the apartment, as happened during the Great Depression.
Yeah,
and it's a tough sell. That analysis may be a tough sell to a lot of people in the movement because it means civil disobedience.
It means attracting heat.
It does.
But it means attracting heat en masse to overcome pointed assaults on individual people and families.
Right, and I think if enough people are involved, if you have a critical mass of people.
Yeah.
Then the type of crackdown that is is usually the response that is the response of the state, is not able to kind of target, target individuals. There's power in numbers when it comes to taking over a welfare office.
So you don't think they'll come and get us after this interview, eh?
No.
No, okay, all right. Well, needless to say.
I hope not. Maybe in my next interview we'll be done from the jail cell. I don't know. I'll call you on.
Yeah. Well, needless to say, it's time for the caveat. We are not recommending illegal activity.
Right.
We are merely discussing the potential of disrupting business as usual for drawing attention to the plight of Ontario's poor.
Exactly.
Very good. Well, I thank you for your time to talk about this. It's a difficult time. It's an inflection point, it seems. We won't really know for what until the vote takes place, which looks like early May, on the budget, and what comes out at the time of that vote, whether any significant concessions have been made, whether the NDP have joined with the Conservatives in saying this is unacceptable. We need an election now. We'll see.
We will see.
Okay. All right. Good night, Simon, and thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
All right. Bye-bye. Simon Black wanted you to be aware of his Twitter handle, too. It's @_SimonBlack. Now for a different kind of traveling music at the show's end, Bob Dylan's Times They Are A-Changin' by Eric Bibb.
Gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept that soon you'll be drenched to the bone if your time to you is worth saving. Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a change. Come writers and critics, prophesize with your pen. Keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. Don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. There's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changin'. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside that's raging. It'll soon shake your windows, it'll rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changin'. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changin'. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, and the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changin'.